This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martorano. We're here on Saturdays. We're talking about the disease of addiction. You know it is much in the news. And we try to stay on top of what's current about this story. But most importantly, we're here to remind you that there are ways to get sober. Millions of people. The last figures I saw suggest that there are over 20 million people in this country alone living in successful long-term sobriety. So we're not here to tell you it's easy, but we're here to tell you it's possible. Recovery Radio is sponsored by Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. Periodically, we rely upon Retreat for everything, certainly expert in the field. Their clinicians come in here, their executives come in and talk about what goes on at a place like Retreat, and it's a valuable resource. We also like to bring in people who have been in the trenches, who have been through this disease, who fight it every day of their lives and maintain sobriety. We have another of those stories today. They are all members of Retreat's alumni organization, the director of which is with us to introduce today's guest. And we welcome back Maggie Hunt to the program. Hi, Maggie. How are you?
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
No, it's a pleasure. We appreciate the alumni group. These stories are very, very powerful. I'm a little hesitant to talk about satisfied customers because it's not like that. But there is some power in people going, look, does treatment work? I'm 2 years sober. I'm 3 years sober, so it's working for me. So it's real valuable to have the alumni group on here. Before we say hello to the person that you're going to introduce us to today, tell us a little about the alumni organization. How long has it been in effect, and what does it do?
So we have had alumni. We've had alumni pretty much since the beginning, mainly because people would come in and they asked if they could give back. They wanted to. However, we didn't really necessarily have anything consistent or on a regular basis. As we continue to get larger and larger as an organization, we couldn't really house all of them like with the inpatient. So in probably about February, I took over, and we have I just hit the ground running with how we can connect alumni, how we can, now we have Pennsylvania and Florida, so how we can kind of like, be across the coast from each other and connect with each other, and have, just celebrate milestones for them. Our guest who we have today is one who is, consistently and so reliable, and she is always there. And whatever, I ask of her to help with the alumni, she is like on top of. She's amazing.
Before we introduce her, you guys do events together. I mean, there are trips, and how is an alumni organization, when they gather in particular, different than, say, a 12-step meeting?
So we are 12-step neutral, being that we are just alumni from Retreat. So if you were, either an inpatient or outpatient as an alumni, you have that common bond that you were all there. So when we invite people to come speak, we say, like, we're 12-step neutral. So whatever fellowship that individual chooses, to call home, that's how they tell their story. We kind of incorporate it as a 12-step model, but we're not, not AA, not, NA. And we also like provide food and provide new experiences for them, like trips, Washington D.C., Philadelphia, different events that we plan as well. So that would be separate because it's not based 100% on traditions; it's more on experience.
I thought it was important to make that distinction so people understood how this thing was organized. So who do we have today from the alumni group?
Yes, so I have Teresa. Teresa is my go-to down in Florida, and she does the meetings for me down there every single Tuesday. So I will introduce Teresa.
Teresa, welcome to Recovery Radio. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
So help us get to know you. Tell us where you're born, your family, what's your background?
I was born in Dover, New Jersey. I'm 25 now, and my parents stayed together until I was about 14. I'm an only child. And, I thought it was normal. And my parents were very angry growing up, and I thought that was normal. And
your parents were angry towards you, or just in general they were angry?
They were. My mom was like angry at the world, but she mostly took it out on me. My dad was more reserved. He kind of just would have outbursts of anger. So when I was 14, there was a huge blow up. My mom moved 2 hours away to South Jersey. And from there, it was just a constant battle of who did I want to live with. My dad remarried. My mom also remarried. And my stepdad's been in my life since I was 14. When I was 20, my dad passed away. So I'm still working on that relationship with my dad's side of the family. We're not as close, but my mom's family and I were very close.
How old are you, Teresa?
25.
So it's interesting. I always like to say when I hear stories about substance abuse and recovery is that these stories are all essentially the same, only they're different. And you are demonstrating that in spades. Very often people will call and make a direct point that they had a sort of idyllic childhood. They want to be very clear that there was nothing in their childhood that would indicate they were going to wind up abusing drugs or alcohol. But you don't sound like you've had that. You don't exactly have that, you know, father knows best background, right?
Yes.
A lot of tension in the house growing up, a lot of anxiety about that stuff?
Yeah, definitely.
To what extent? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Growing up, I was afraid to even talk to my parents because I was afraid of what their reaction was going to be.
You mean you were afraid that it might trigger another outburst?
Exactly.
Was there anything physical going on? Any physical abuse going on in the household?
I mean, not like majorly. I mean, I get smacked around here and there, but.
Well, it's amazing. It's amazing how you've made that seem ordinary. So there was physical abuse.
Yes.
Yeah. We're going to get into your history of substance abuse. I don't want to get too deeply into it now, the particulars of it. But looking back on it, to what extent do you attribute your problems with the atmosphere you grew up in?
I attributed a lot to my addiction with trying to just deal with how I was feeling because I feel like when I was growing up, I wasn't able to express it.
You weren't able to express the way you were feeling?
Yes, like I would have to hold it in.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting, Maggie, is that no matter what the environment is in growing up for people who wind up suffering from this disease, the same sort of result occurs. If there is no anxiety or tension or physical abuse, there's still this free-floating sense that I don't fit. There's something wrong even with that. And then you get Teresa's story where there is stuff going on, mm-hmm. and the result is still the same. Does that suggest that the disease stands apart from these circumstances?
Yeah, I would think so. I think that the part I like to break down, right, the word disease, D-I-S, E-I-S-E. So like I'm at dis-ease with life, right? And I think that it kind of comes from like a spiritual sickness really than anything else. Because when you're connected, you don't feel that way. But when you are disconnected, that's when you like feel like you're not a part of and you have all of those feelings, whatever the circumstances were in your environment.
Mm-hmm. So Teresa, I wonder whether you at some point, because this disease feeds on denial, were able to abuse substances as a young woman and blame it on that family situation. Did you find yourself doing that?
Absolutely.
Which all the time. Yeah, which is doubly a shame because, in fact, that's not what's going on, right?
Exactly. The problem was with me and not being spiritually connected. And I took it out on, my dad died. oh, my mom used to hit me, or I would use all those excuses.
Yeah, in a sense, you're doubly punished for the lousy environment in the household when you're a kid, because on the one hand, it's a lousy environment, and on the other hand, it provides for you a tangible, although phony, narrative, right? You can blame these problems on these two people who were, you know, terrible parents. That just makes it even harder. We hear from people all the time who, as I said, are quick to point out they had terrific childhoods, so they can't blame it on anybody. But you could. You think that prolonged your problems?
Yeah, I used that for excuses for years.
Did you ever confront your mom and just say, yeah, I messed up and you messed me up?
Absolutely. I remember there was a time that I would tell my mom that this was all her fault.
And her reaction to that would be, first of all, she's probably inclined to believe that anyway, right?
Absolutely.
And what was her reaction to being accused of causing all this?
Anger. Oh, outbursts of anger.
Really? Well, that seemed to be her default mode anyway, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's amazing. This is one of the strangest diseases in the history of diseases. It can change and shape and make itself anything it needs to be in order to keep its hooks in the people it's got. So it's always valuable to hear stories like this. Teresa is our guest. She is over 2 years sober now, and when she comes back, she's going to take us through more of her story of substance abuse. You're listening to Recovery Radio, so stay right there. We're back. This is Recovery Radio. We have another in a series of interviews we bring from time to time from people who are part of an alumni group that Retreat runs, made up of people who have, at long last in many cases, achieved a measure of sobriety and are now part of this alumni group where they share their experiences with people who have been down the same road. Maggie Hunt, the director of this alumni program, is with us when we have these programs. She sets them up and she introduces us to these people who share their stories. Teresa Best is our guest today. Teresa is over 2 years now sober, and she's taking us through her history of this disease. Teresa, at what point do you recall first experimenting with drugs or alcohol? When did that start for you?
14.
And tell us about the circumstances.
My mom had just moved 2 hours away from my dad. I was always surrounding myself with older people who I would make my friends, so they would be able to get me alcohol. And it started off with drinking, and then I ended up moving with my mom, and I found these group of friends that were smoking weed, and I wanted to fit in. It was a new town. I knew nobody, so I figured if I could make myself like them, I'd have friends.
You know, I stop here now and ask Maggie what her experience in this regard is, because one of the reasons that I think it's important to hear these stories is so that people who are not maybe don't have this disease in their family or their life, but have young children, for instance, and they're constantly looking for red flags. Are there any real red flags to distinguish traditional teenage behavior with problem behavior? One of the things I keep hearing is older friends. Is that something somebody should be on the lookout for?
Yeah, well, I would say for friends, but also my mom used to say when I was younger, she would say, show me your friends and I'll show you who you are. So, you know, when you're younger and you're hanging out with people who are, you know, in similar sports activities or, you know, extracurricular activities or from school, like, you know, they're decent people, you bring them to your house. But when you start hanging out with people who are using substances, they are significantly older. They might dress extremely different. They might act different. And they might not be, you know, they might wear sideways hats. I'm not really sure. Even, you know, you never know. But when there's a big change in who they're hanging out with.
Yeah, the two things. Yeah,
that.
big change. And boy, I love that. Show me your friends. I'll show you who you are. That's for those of you listening, looking for some advice. Keep that in mind. So Teresa, you are like everybody else we talk to about these things. In order to normalize your behavior, even though it's not normal, you just surround yourself with like-minded people. It starts with marijuana. Tell us about your first experience with marijuana. What was that like?
I did not know what to expect. I did it, and I remember the day that I did it, I kept saying no, 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 and they were like, oh, just try it, you'll feel better. And it was just this feeling of, I was finally, like, out of my head.
Explain. What was wrong with being in your head? What was going on?
I just was constantly questioning myself, like, why don't I fit in? Why is my mom always so angry? Why do I make her so angry?
And this alleviated that.
Yes, I was out of my head, even if it was for an hour or two.
Mm-hmm.
I was finally calm.
This all happens at, you say, 14 years of age?
Yes.
And you're also being introduced to this stuff by people who maybe don't have the same reasons for doing it. It looks kind of social. I mean, after all, it's not unusual for 14-year-olds to experiment with marijuana. How soon after that first experience did you begin to recognize it was different for you?
It was a couple of years because I figured I'm fitting in. And over those couple of years, until I got to the next substance, it was more consistent.
Yeah. What was the next substance?
My next substance was pills, Xanax. Percocet, things like that.
Can you, to the extent possible, tell us why you stepped up? Was it just somebody said, try this, and you liked that? Or were you thinking, gee, I need a different high? I'm fascinated by this, the progression through drugs, how that happens. What was your experience?
My experience was, I was actually, I think I was 17, and I was outside of work, and I was hanging out with my friend, and she's like, I have these pills, I got them from my mom. They're supposed to, you know, really relax you and make you feel good. And I was like, I'll try it.
Well, you were getting, and yeah, I got it. Go ahead, continue.
I tried it, and it actually, like, put me in a state of, like, I was, like, sedated.
And you like that.
I didn't have to steal.
Yeah. So let me ask you something, and I'll ask Maggie this. She's the clinician here. So we hear this stuff about marijuana being a gateway drug. Is that true in your view? And does it even matter with regard to somebody who has the disease of addiction?
I definitely think it is a gateway drug, and not necessarily because if you use marijuana, you're going to use other substances, but if you're going to use marijuana, the people who you're going to get it from also probably use those substances, and that's where the step up comes. There's always somebody else within, like, that world that can, like, get you something different. So that's where the gateway comes from. And, you know, like, people who are using this substance will stay together and this substance. And that's where the step up, you know, you continue to step up when you continue to hang out with those people. But, the gateway drug is where it starts from, and that's where it starts from. And there's usually a progression.
Yeah. Certainly that's what Teresa Best has just described to us. Teresa, so from pills to what?
It went from pills to heroin.
How quickly?
I believe I was on heroin by 19.
So that's a couple of years, right?
Yes.
And how were you? How were you taking? Are we start with pills, painkillers?
Yeah, started with the Percocet, and it quickly moved to heroin.
And did you use it intravenously ultimately?
Towards the end.
How long were you?
At first.
Yeah, go ahead.
At first, I would just sniff it.
Right. And just characterize so that period of time was a couple of years of seriously abusing opiates.
Yes.
We're talking with Teresa Best, who is now over 2 years successful sobriety. She's taking us through the background of substance abuse, and she's going to tell us now in the next segment when that stops, or at least is halted by the notion of sobriety. This is Recovery Radio. We have more straight ahead. Don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. We have yet another in a series of alumni interviews that we bring you. These are people that are living in successful long-term sobriety. They are members of Retreat's alumni organization. The head of that, Maggie Hunt, with us. She provides our contact with these folks. We like having Maggie with us when we do the interviews. Teresa Best is with us on the telephone talking about her now, well, she's going to get to it, 2 years plus of sobriety. Teresa, you go marijuana, benzodiazepines, and then right in, painkiller pills, and then heroin. How bad did your heroin habit ultimately get become? I mean, in terms
was getting so bad that it wasn't enough. So that's when I started adding in crack cocaine and alcohol.
How old were you at this point? You were like 19, 20? What were you at this point?
I was between 19 and 20.
Mm-hmm. Were you chasing a high at that point, or were you doing something else? I mean, we've heard lots of people say, I just don't want to get sick. What were you doing?
I had become so addicted that I did not think I did not think I could ever get off of it. And at that time, I thought everybody in the whole world was on something.
Well, explain that to me. What is that? What do you mean? In other words, in order to rationalize your behavior, you had to think everybody was doing this.
Exactly. Like, I would be driving in the car, and like the person next to me would just be looking so happy and like singing a song in their car, and I'd be like, they have to be on something too.
No, did you really?
That's how you feel good.
And you really believe that?
At the time, I did.
Well, this is an amazing process. Again, it helps people on the outside looking at the disease understand how you could behave the way you did. You could not conceive of anyone being happy and whole and drug free. So when you saw someone who appeared to be okay, you just naturally assume they had to be taking something.
Correct.
It is astonishing for someone who's never had this disease or seen this disease up close. But it's common, isn't it, Maggie?
Oh, yeah. It's definitely common. And it's like almost a cognitive distortion, right? And that's how you have to that's how we have to like lay down at the end of the day, right? Is that like everybody must be doing these things because your life seems like the only normal one. So therefore, like everyone else, it should be the same. And everybody should be using substances.
Teresa, and I'll ask Maggie to respond as well. Part of your brain must reject that idea. And it's too frightening to think, gee, everyone isn't doing this. Only people with a problem are doing this. Rather than accept that, I'm going to create this fantasy that everybody's high. So that's what's going on in your head, right?
Yeah.
So when do you suddenly realize that's not true, you're messed up, and I got to do something about it? When did that happen for you the first time?
Basically, it was like my dad died. I really went on a rampage at 20, and it went on for a good year. In a three-month span after I had turned 21, I had gotten into a car accident from drunk driving, overdosed, and then ended up in jail. And that's when I got sent to my first rehab.
So it was an involuntary trip to rehab?
Yes.
And your attitude was, I'll just do this, get out, so I can get high again?
Yes.
You remember actually feeling like that?
Mm-hmm. I didn't quite understand. I felt like, oh, I hadn't been shooting up. I was only sniffing it, and I don't have a problem with alcohol. Maybe it's all the other substances, but not alcohol.
Yeah, you're making deals with yourself, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing that I hear very, very often is that you're able to rationalize. For instance, you had an accident, a DUI, you get arrested, and you got a court saying, you know, you're able to rationalize that by saying, I was unlucky.
I also rationalized it because the day I got into a car accident was the 1 year anniversary of my dad's death.
Right. You had,
so I was like, I was only as drunk as I was because it was the anniversary of his death.
Yeah. Yeah. What do people expect? I mean, after all, right?
Yeah, if you had this life, you would use too.
Yeah. In fact, if I don't get, I mean, I'd be crazy not to get high. All those games are played. How many times were you in treatment altogether, Teresa?
5 inpatients, and I can't even count how many outpatients.
Were they all involuntary, or were some of them voluntary? How did that work?
My first trip to the retreat was involuntary. My second trip was voluntary.
What?
So everyone after that, I slowly would become more willing to go to treatment.
You know, it's interesting, and I want to get Maggie Hunt to comment on this as well. I tell people who constantly say to me, who don't know about the disease, they all relapse, it's relapse. And I just say, yeah, you know what? They do. A lot of people do. Not all of them, but a lot of them do. A lot of them, many of them do it multiple times. But you know what's interesting? They keep trying.
Mm-hmm.
They keep trying. So there is something, we talk about treatment being a process, and it's, I guess, true that relapse is part of that process, right? It doesn't have to be, but it is.
Yeah, there's a saying that says relapse is not a requirement, but it's part of my story is what people will say. So it's not a requirement. It doesn't have to be that that's the case. It is the case pretty regularly when people don't follow suggestion. So
that's
why our statistics are not good.
Teresa, were you – tell us about the relapses. Were you discouraged each time, or how did you feel when you would relapse? Ashamed? What?
I was very ashamed. I would go do what they said. I would start to do the meetings, and then I would get discouraged because I didn't understand the program, or I just felt like at the time I didn't fit in because some of them would tell stories and they would be so in depth, and I'd be like, I haven't gotten there yet. I don't belong here.
How important is sharing in situations like this? Is it, I mean, can some people sit in rooms, for instance, silently and get any benefit from the fellowship? What do you think, Teresa?
From my perspective, me staying quiet and not putting my hand up definitely did not help me in that case. I really believe that you have to get involved.
I'm just getting from listening to you, and I could be completely wrong here, that at least initially that was hard for you, right?
Yes.
Sharing felt like what? Too scary, or you didn't think your story was good enough, or what? Why would someone sit there and not share in a meeting?
I didn't feel that my story qualified, like I didn't qualify enough to be a part of a program.
So you heard other people's story and thought, wow, their story is way worse than mine. I'm a half a fraud here.
Exactly.
Which is the same feeling that got you in trouble to begin with, right? That you didn't.
Exactly.
So now it's so amazing. And again, you never fit, so you start using drugs. Somehow or another, you find yourself in a room where you're supposed to be getting support and acknowledging that you don't need drugs, and the drugs are telling you once again, you don't even fit here.
Exactly. Even when I put the drugs down, I didn't understand why things weren't getting better for me, why I was still feeling the way I was feeling.
Again, for people who struggle with trying to understand this as a medical condition rather than a character flaw, consider Teresa's experience where there is a hole in her life that she feels at a very young age, attempts to fill it with or self-medicate it with drugs so that she can achieve a kind of wholeness and suddenly I fit, then through horrible circumstances finds herself in treatment and the disease is saying to her again, you don't belong here. You don't even fit here. What are you doing here? I'm laughing because it's just so extraordinarily difficult to handle the disease of addiction, and so very easy to just blame it on people being lazy.
Oh, yeah.
Or bad people. Did you think you were a bad person, Teresa?
Absolutely. I thought I was horrible.
What changed? You're 2 years plus now sober. When did it start to take hold of you that you could do better?
I saw people that I had gone to treatment with previous doing it, and I had started to talk to them, and they had just keep telling me, give it a chance. I also had a lot of people that I went to treatment with die, and that's when I got to the point where I was either going to give this one shot like everyone kept telling me to, or I was just going to be okay with dying.
Teresa Bess is our guest. She is 2+ years sober now. Her sobriety not only is saving her life, as she's just described, but it also directed her in a whole new career. We'll find out more about that straight ahead. This is Recovery Radio. Please don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. I want to remind you once again, any questions or comments you have about the disease of addiction or the treatment that's available, you can call Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, the sponsor of the program. They will provide information. 855-859-8808. From that organization, Maggie Hunt, she joins us periodically. She handles the alumni program and is responsible for providing us with the guests from that group that we have on throughout the week. So we thank you again, Mag. I know that you know Teresa from her story and her membership in the alumni group, but you are also now her colleague,
mm-hmm.
and we will tell you how that happened straight ahead. But Teresa, it's 2.5 years now sober. Just if you can briefly, that moment 2.5 years ago when things start to work for you, tell us about that.
I had gone to treatment again, and in treatment, my attitude. I had a very big entitlement issue up until I was about 9 months sober. I thought that I knew everything, that I just went to treatment, to detox, got out. And then when I finally started going to meetings, that's when I got the courage to put my hand up, get a support group. I went to an all-women's halfway, and I found women, coincidentally, who were older than me, trying to do the right thing. And from there, it just took off. Like, things were getting better. For a long time, my family started to help me again. For a while, they were helping me pay my rent. And my attitude still was, all right, well, you got what you wanted. I'm sober. Yeah, things are getting better. You're going to pay my rent, and I'm just not going to get a job. And then things started to change within me. I changed my behaviors. I got a job. I started making slow attempts at being responsible. Like, today I'm actually grateful that I can pay my rent.
It sounds so ordinary. It sounds so obvious to people on the outside. You really can't appreciate what an achievement that is, to be able to do the simplest things like pay your rent, write a check, pay a bill. Teresa, as the whole thing was starting to work for you, you were in a series of sort of, dead-end jobs, really. And then you made a decision that this was something you wanted to do with your life. Tell us what you're doing now.
I am a clinical aide at the Retreat of Palm Beach.
How long have you been doing that?
I've been in the field for about a year, but I've been with Retreat for about 6 months.
Maggie, tell us about how that happened for Teresa, because she's not alone in that career change, right?
Yeah, no. I always say that alumni actually make the best staff because they're super and always like the most difficult patients are always really good staff members because they can't get one over on them. But for Teresa, she had reached out to me. We have an alumni Facebook page, and she had messaged me on the Facebook page, and she said, hey, you know, this is how long I'm sober. I work in the field, and I want to work at retreat. Is that possible? And she put in an application, and she had an interview. And I think that she was surprised that she got the job, you know, at first. But, I wasn't really surprised. And then when we started having alumni down there, she, you know, expressed a huge interest in wanting to help. And since then, I've just been carrying on her strength to want to do more and help alumni as much as possible.
Teresa, I'm going to ask you the question. Do you view your work now as merely your work, or is it also your work and part of your support? In other words, are you getting healthier and stronger because you're in the field you're in?
Yes. That's kind of a blurred line for me. I still have to have my supports outside of work and go to my meetings, but at the same time, I'm able to go to work and see people be as broken as I was, come in multiple times and be able to say to them, I was there too, just keep hanging on.
Yeah, again, another kind of confusion that exists outside is this notion that people who are in some kind of successful, sober situations need to work in this field because, in fact, they're still in treatment. And that's really not the case. That is really not the case. I know, first of all, it's not easy to get a job at retreat, no matter what your treatment history has been or the fact that you're sober. But there is a special skill. I mean, there's nothing like somebody telling you, I've been there. So I can certainly appreciate your situation. Tell us about the alumni group. Do you enjoy your involvement with them?
I absolutely love it because a lot of these people I've seen come in since day one, and to see them still coming to alumni every week 6 months later, and to see their light like go back on in their eyes is just amazing.
Well, 2.5 years of sobriety and a new career now in the treatment field is an achievement. You should be proud of yourself. We congratulate you and wish you continued success. Thanks for joining us on Recovery Radio.
Thank you very much.
And the rest of you, enjoy your weekend, and please look for us. We're here on Saturdays, Recovery Radio. Bye-bye.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.